Good morning. This is the Bitcoin Optech Newsletter Recap 302. As you can hear, I'm not Mike. This is Merch. Today, I'm going to be the main host. I'm joined by Dave today.
Hi, I'm Dave Harding. I'm co-author of the Optech Newsletter and co-author of the third edition of Mastering Bitcoin.
And by Calvin.
Yep, hello.
Yeah, well, we'll jump into your topic anyway soon, Calvin, but if you want, you can start by introducing yourself a little bit.
Yeah, sorry, my mic wasn't unmuted. So yeah, I'm Calvin. I work on a project called UtriXO, and we just did a beta release of it. So excited to share that with you guys.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us. So yeah, we're jumping into the newsletter, and the first news item is exactly that, the release of the UtriXOD beta. And you posted to the Bitcoin dev mailing list to announce it, and you have full node support working with UtriXO. So as we've discussed here before a few times, UtriXO is a different way of storing the UtriXO set in the form of commitments. So you actually prove that a UtriXO exists in order to validate transactions. Is that right? Do you want to tell us a little more about the recent changes?
Yeah, that's right. And so UtriXO is just a set of Merkle trees. And so what we do is we take the UtriXO set and we represent that as Merkle trees. So the node, the full node implementation that has this implemented is the one that we just released is called UtriXOD. And it has support for the full node, as in like fully validating everything with the UtriXO accumulators, and it also has support for what we call bridge nodes, which attaches proofs like the accumulator proofs to new blocks and new transactions. So so we were trying to get it stable enough to have a beta release for a while now, and it's working well enough that I feel confident that people can try it out.
So yeah, very cool.
To try.
Yeah, very cool. So you were talking about bridge nodes. So naturally, we could dive a little into why we need bridge nodes in the regular or in the existing Bitcoin network. People send around transactions. Everybody has the entire UtriXO set, or all the full nodes do. So they have all the information necessary to determine on their own whether a transaction is complete and valid. With UtriXO, you only have this set of Merkle trees that commits to all the existing UtriXOs, but you don't actually store the entire UtriXO set, from what I understand. So what the bridge nodes do is they add the proofs that UtriXOs exist, or where to find them in the Merkle tree, or how does the bridging work?
Right, and so normally, the normal expectation for a full node right now is that everyone has the entire UtriXO set. And so whenever you receive a new block, the block has UtriXOs that it's pointing to that it's trying to spend, like the transactions. And so normally that's expected to be kept with you. You're expected to store it, but with the UtriXO model, you're not expected to store it. And you're also not... Yeah, you're not expected to store it. So you receive that data along with the block, and to sort of prove that the data that you received was indeed correct, you have the Merkle proofs for those. And once you verify everything, then once you verify that the data that you received is indeed committed into the UtriXO accumulator, then you can validate the block as normal.
Very cool.
So, yeah. So
that sounds like an... You go ahead, sorry.
I was going to just say that, we need these bridge nodes to avoid having a soft fork. So there, one of the ways that we can provide these proofs is something like where we force the miners to have the UtriXO proofs in the Coinbase, and that can be a way we could do things. But having these bridge nodes in the network is a way to avoid soft forks. So that's why we could just announce it and release it instead of having to go through the entire the entire, like, the consensus for a software.
Right. So the bridge nodes essentially are a translation layer that adds the proofs that anchor or the information about the UTXOs to the trees that the lightweight node has already. And now UTXOD allows people to run an extremely lightweight node. And I assume the idea would be to integrate that, for example, into light clients or what do you see as the target audience?
Yeah, and so at the right, and UTXOD supports both the bridge node capability as well as the really tiny node capabilities. And so with the really tiny node, at the moment, we're seeing this as just as a UX improvement. And we're sort of trying to target like wallets, and so they could pre-integrate UTXO into their wallets. And so if you download a wallet, you were you're previously dependent on like a third party server, but with this, it would be feasible for you to self-validate and not have to fetch for the blockchain data.
So it's a security improvement while keeping it extremely lightweight still, but you need these bridge nodes. So what you're asking is for some people to get interested in the beta and to create some sort of first set of bridge nodes?
Yes. And so at the moment, there's not that many. We actually are trying to spin up a few extra so that folks can connect to them. But yeah, so there's not that many bridge nodes, and there's also not that many archival nodes as well. And so either would be very good to have. I should mention that bridge nodes are only responsible for attaching the proofs for new blocks and transactions. Everything else works the same as before, where an archival node will store the entirety of the blockchain and the UTXO proof if you're a UTXO archival node.
So when you synchronize, do you just jump ahead to the end, or do you actually have to go through all the blocks with the proofs?
Yes. So that is another feature that UTXOD has. And so some of you folks might be aware of Assume UTXO project, where the whole idea is that we have a hash of the UTXO set committed into the binary that you download. And when you download the binary, you have the committed hash, and you download the entire UTXO set and compare the hash with the one that you received with your binary. And if that's correct, then great. Then you can start off from some block that's close to the tip. We do the same exact thing, but it's Assume UTXO, where we don't just give you the hash commitment of the UTXO set, we give you the entire representation of the UTXO set. So with Assume UTXO, you still have to download, now it's about like 12 gigabytes of the UTXO set before you can get started, but with this, you can immediately get started from wherever the UTXO roots were provided at. So that is a feature of UTXOD. Another thing that you can do is you could turn that off, and so you're removing that trust element from the developer, and you can sync from Genesis and check every single block and every single UTXO proof as normal. So you could do both.
So would that be per the regular synchronization mechanism from BTCD, or would that also use a special mechanism from UTXO?
So it includes both the regular synchronization from BTCD as well as extra codes for UTXO. So everything else, like script validation, like checking how much the amounts and stuff, that's all correct, like the proof of work headers. Everything else is correct, but except for fetching the UTXOs, now you would, for the BTCD code, you would still expect to fetch that from your local database. With UTXO, you expect to receive that from your peers.
Awesome. Okay. Dave, do you have any more questions or comments?
Sure, I have a few questions. But first of all, thanks, Calvin, for working on this. Obviously, it's been a long-term project, both of the community and of yours in particular. So thank you so much for sticking with it and getting to this beta version. So I'm very appreciative of that. One of my questions is, For communicating the proofs, I assume you need extensions to the PDP protocol. Can you talk about what those are? How significant are they? Are they big changes? Are they little changes? And, you know, is that something you're going to get to a specification point, you know, open a BIP and, you know, just standardize?
Your microphone is off, I think.
Oh, it's weird. On some places, Dave, I can hear Dave, but for my speaker, I can't hear Dave.
Oh, well. So Dave asked what P2P changes would be necessary to make UTXO D work, and whether you are going to standardize that, for example, for a BIP, if I gather that correctly.
Ah, yes. So the P2P changes required are... it's basically a new message for a block and a new message for a transaction. So the current message is that you only receive the Bitcoin block, but then we also want to receive the UTXO proof with it. And that UTXO proof that you receive has to be in a specific format for the verification to work. And so there's that. And then there's also the transaction parts where you ask when you receive a transaction, when you receive an info transaction, you also ask for what proof, like what information do you need to verify that transactions, whether that transaction exists in the UTXO set or not. And so those are the two main changes needed to the P2P protocol. And at the moment, myself and Davidson, who is the author of another implementation called Floresta, is we're writing that up at the moment in Bangkok in Bob Spaces.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to reviewing your BIP. We have a question from the audience. Mike, you're on.
Hey, Calvin, question or a couple questions. One is, do you foresee any sort of, I guess you could say, political downside, or like people like pushing back hard against this? I know I've heard like Taj talk about this like a bunch.
I've never heard checking, but is it just me that can't hear anything, or is it others as well?
I can hear it fine, unfortunately.
Oh no. Okay. Well, maybe Merch, you can just like repeat my question for Calvin. The TLDR is like, does he foresee any pushback on this, and what would those like potential kind of conversations be? So like that's sort of general. And then the second question is what use cases. Okay, right, yeah, we'll do that one.
Kevin, I'm gonna translate the question. So Mike is interested whether you foresee any sort of political skepticism with this new model of Node, and what sort of conversations you anticipate to have in the community.
Oh, I think the most, well, really the best part of how we're approaching this to you know, adoption with new users is that it's 100% optional. So if you don't want it, just ignore it, and nothing changes for you. If you want it, then yes, participate in it, and you're not forcing anyone to do, you know, any upgrades that they don't want to. And so in that sense, I really don't think this should be controversial at all. But of course, I haven't heard all of the opinions out there. And so I would actually be interested in hearing like different opinions, and if there are people that are against this, like why they would be against this.
Thanks. Cool. Mike?
And then the second one is, what use cases and what does this enable that he's like really excited about? So like, for instance, like, does this relate to something with Lightning? Does this relate to something with something else like Light clients? Like what kind of use case is he super excited about that this will help enable, besides like maybe the obvious like scaling, you know, easy kind of stuff, or I don't know.
All right, Calvin, the second question is, what use cases are you most excited about that get enabled or improved by this option?
Well, really the thing that we're trying to go for at the moment is we're not trying to convert the existing node runners. We're trying to convert the people that are not running nodes, because it's not a good UX to do so. And it's difficult for people to do so. And so for these people, what we want to do is it doesn't even have to be that they're aware of they're running a node. It's like, okay, if I pick this wallet software, I know that it's fully validating everything. And because of that, I choose to run the software. I think that's a really good thing to target at. And so even though, you know, some people might be skeptical because, hey, like, this is different consensus code versus like Bitcoin cores, but now you're going from like a light client or to SPV type of security to full node security, even though it might be different implementations. So that's what I'm really excited about for this release.
All right. So your argument is the target market is improving the security of light clients that have a reduced security right now to what they would have under a U-Trixo model. Would that be applicable to Lightning wallets, for example?
For at the moment, it is not, because we do. There is a workaround around us, but if we want to do it properly, the Lightning channel announcements need to be changed, because when you do a channel announcement, you just point to a UTXO, an outpoint. But if you're a UTXO node, you don't know if that exists because there is no UTXO proof attached to it. And so we also need to change the Lightning network protocol in order for Lightning nodes to be able to use this properly. So that's that's something that we want to do down the line, but not at the moment. We have that planned.
So I see you would need to add the UTXO proof to the announcement of the channel in an extra P2P message or something, like a variant of the existing.
That is my knowledge, yes.
Dave, did you have another comment or question?
A quick comment is that I think in next week's newsletter, we're going to cover an idea for Lightning announcements to be based on a ring signature, which I think would be kind of fundamentally incompatible with UTXO. So that's just a point. And my question for Calvin, my last question would be, you know, what are his goals for the next year or so in UTXO? Obviously, he's going to accept feedback from this and iterate, but, you know, where does he see the project going in the next year?
All right, Calvin, could you hear that?
Well, I didn't hear everything. Could you repeat the last parts that they said?
Okay, so he mentioned that in the next newsletter, we're probably going to cover a proposal to announce Lightning channel anchors, or sorry, funding outputs via ring signatures. And he was wondering whether that's fundamentally incompatible with UTXO. And the other thing was what your plan is in the next year or two, where you want to take the project.
This is kind of funny because I literally just talked about this with Taj an hour ago. And yeah, it would be fundamentally incompatible, and maybe it would be compatible, but it's still, we're thinking about how to implement things. So yeah, that's to be determined. For myself, next year or two down the road, at the moment, what I want to do is I want to get things more stable. I want to spec things out so that it could be peer reviewed, and we could have other people, you know, have other developers, you know, integrate UTXO into their projects and get adoption in that way. And beyond that, I guess the next thing would be to get some sort of an implementation going for Bitcoin Core. But I'm not, at the moment, I don't have that in my mind. I'm just thinking for the next year. And for the next year, just, you know, more stability and spec and peer review.
Awesome. What sort of help or input or activities from the audience would you wish for? So run a node, obviously. Anything else?
Yeah, at the moment, please try out the software. To my best ability, it is stable and working. Try out the wallets that are integrated. Try out the BDK wallet. Try out the Electrum wallet that is integrated with it. Try the Assume UTXO. You know, try fully syncing. It would be nice to have more eyes on it so that if there are bugs, then we can catch them. And yeah, and for other fellow developers out there, we're currently writing up BIPs. We'll have that out very, very soon. So some eyes on that would be very helpful as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. You're welcome to stick around. Maybe reconnect if you can't hear all of us, if you want to stick around. If you have other things to do, we understand. But thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Cool. We are getting to the second news item this week. We will talk about BIP 119, which is OpsCTV or Check Template Verify. There is a new BIP that Jeremy proposed, which extends CTV in two aspects. And one of those aspects is instead of making a hash that is 32 bytes to commit to the whatever properties you are looking for in the future transactions, there is now a proposal to use a hash with 160 bits, so 20 bytes. The idea here is, in a single signer scenario, this can probably be secure enough, but it would make the commitment 12 bytes smaller, which would be cheaper, cost less block space. The other one would be to be able to commit to witness stack items. Originally, there was an idea that you could commit to up return outputs to have some data. And with the witness commitment, you could actually store data more cheaply, as we have learned in the last year. Dave, you probably looked a lot more at this. What am I missing?
I don't think you're missing anything at all. So BIP 119 is actually designed to be extendable. So it, as written, it expects a 32-byte object to be on the stack. If it's not exactly 32 bytes, it will it'll unconditionally succeed. So it's upgradable. So we can add either as part of the initial soft fork, if it gets soft forked in, or as a later soft fork, we can add the ability to support, to take different size objects on the stack. So what Jeremy has proposed here is that we can take three additional sizes here. We can take a 20 byte object, which will give you that support for the RIPE-MD 160 hashes, which, like Merch said, those are secure in a single party setting, and they can be secure in a multi-party setting if you take a little extra care in generating that hash. But it's something you've got to be careful about, and that's why I think it wasn't in the base proposal, was that to be absolutely safe, we would prefer to use the strongest hash available in Bitcoin, which is a 32-byte hash. Or we can put on the stack a 21-byte object, which is, I'm sorry, not 21-byte, it is a 21-byte. You can put on 21-byte objects. The extra byte is a flag that tells it to consume an extra argument from the stack. And that's the additional data you want to commit to with the 20-byte hash, or you can put a 33-byte hash on the stack, and the extra byte again tells you to consume an extra element from the stack with the data that you want to commit to when the thing gets spent. The imagined purpose for the both of these things is something like Greg Sanders' design for L2, which is an upgrade to Lightning Network's channel management layer. That allows the person signing the transaction to commit to data, extra data, to put that on the stack that helps them recover from the channel if they lose their state. So L2 is designed so that penalties, it doesn't require penalties. You can just put whatever your current state is on the stack. But you also need a way to recover from part of that state if you've lost it. And so I don't remember exactly how Greg's things work, but he commits to extra data to make recovery easier and safer for L2 channels if you've lost your state along the way. So this just simplifies that and allows that usage and makes it a little bit cheaper by allowing you to use a 20-byte hash rather than a 32-byte hash.
Awesome. That sounds pretty cool. So far I've seen that there wasn't much discussion about this on the mailing list. So if this is interesting to you, maybe check it out. All right. That was a news section. We're getting to releases and release candidates. We have two of those this week. There is the LDK release, the latest. It's 0.0.123. And it's the two features that seem to stick out the most are a lot of improvements to Bolt 12, to the offer process. And we've talked a bunch about this in the last few Uptech recaps, trimmed HTLCs. When an HTLC is not valuable enough to actually write to the chain, some Lightning implementations have now more logical or rational behavior in the sense that they might drop an HTLC that costs more to write to the chain than it is worth. So there seem to be new configuration options in this LDK release in that regard. Okay, cool. And the second release we've talked about or not talked about already a couple times. LND 0.18 beta has a second release candidate now. This is, of course, the most popular node software on the Lightning Network. I assume that lots of listeners are running one version of LND or another. If you rely on the software, you should really look at release candidates. Check out the release notes, test it in your test infrastructure to make sure that it doesn't have any incompatibilities. And we had some of those in the last release, I believe, where we found, or rather, Bitcoin Core amended some limits, and that caused an inconsistency with how LND was interacting with some RPCs. So if you're dependent on LND, please also test this, just like with the UTXOD client, if you have time and cycles. All of this open source work only works when people take a look and chime in. We're still hoping that we'll get someone on the show to talk us through all of the new features of LND. Once it is released, we'll probably have one of their engineers on. Cool. Anything else, Dave, there, or should we move on? All right, cool. So in the last section, we talk about notable code and documentation changes. We look at a bunch of open source projects and the BIPS repository and Bolts and Inquisition and Bananas and so forth. We have a bunch of those. If you have a question or a comment from the audience, now's a good time to find the request speaker access button, and we'll try to get you in here. So the first code change is from Bitcoin Core, 29,845. We have a change here to multiple RPCs, where previously the warning field on the return or on the response from an RPC call was a single string, and now instead the warning field can take an array of strings. So if there was multiple warnings, you could return all of them. Dave, you wrote up all of these.
So this is just, it's actually possible for multiple things to be going wrong with your node at the same time, or multiple things to be going wrong with the network at the same time. So it's nice to have a array of strings. So each one of those can have its own unique message rather than us all trying to cram them all together in one string or just dropping some. So this is just a nice update we like to put in the newsletter, API changes that might affect people. And if you are running a node in a production setting and you're pulling these RPCs to check the warnings field, you need to know that the string is going to be updated to an array.
Yeah, exactly. Wonderful. Our next change is to Core Lightning. It's pull request 7111, and it makes the check RPC command more powerful. So apparently they have had for a long time already a command that allows you to sort of dry run a RPC another RPC command, and now a bunch of those commands or checks would always succeed instead of actually checking what you pass them. And this pull request seems to improve a number of those and actually make Core Lightning check the input and return a proper response instead of just trivially always saying it worked. Back to you, Dave.
that's correct. So the check RPC, like you said, you want to run another RPC, one of the regular RPCs, and you just pass it with all the parameters you want to use to the check RPC, and it will tell you if it's malformed. And the problem here was that Core Lightning is built on a very extensible architecture. It's very plugin based. But for plugins, for commands that were not core commands to Core Lightning, commands that were provided by a plugin, the check RPC would always succeed. You know, it would say, it would go to the plugins and it would say, oh, that's a plugin, and just always succeed. So now plugins can specify the stuff necessary for the RPCs to be checked with the check RPC command.
I find it funny how similar this is to the UpSuccess soft fork hook. We have a bunch of opcodes in TypeScript, which always succeed. As soon as they appear in a script, they will make the node say, oh, this is a valid transaction, or valid input, I should say, sorry. And that allows us, of course, in a future change to restrict when it succeeds. And that's, for example, the upgrade hook that is proposed for opcat, a bit that we recently merged. Anyway, that's fairly far out there. So back to our news items. Another code change that we're talking about is to libsec P256K1. This is a cryptography library that is used by Bitcoin Core and maybe other projects. It is in C and does all of the heavy crypto lifting. It is heavily optimized. Every once in a while, we have a news item here where some signature operation gets a little faster, and it turns out that it makes IBD 5% faster and things like that. That's the library we're talking about. So they added recently a new function which sorts the pub keys, a set of pub keys, lexicographically. And this is, for example, useful for music too and for silent payments. For silent payments, I think it's about having multiple payments in a single transaction. Anyway, Dave, do you have some more on this one?
Yeah, so like in Bitcoin, for a long time, we've had people implementing, I think it's BIP67, which is a descriptor sorted multi, which will put a set of keys into lexicographical order. But in silent payments in Musig, and so that function BIP67 is for keys that appear in a script on chain. But for Musig 2 and for silent payments, we're going to be using keys that are not going to appear on chain. And this is just a nice low-level function in SecP that will allow you to sort the keys. And by sorting keys, you know, if everybody sorts them the same way, you can perform order-dependent operations on that sort. You know, everybody does it the same, so everybody gets the same outcome. So it's a feature that you could do at a higher level, but doing it at a lower level just ensures everybody's doing it exactly the same and there's no mismatches. And if you've had mismatches, you know, I know for silent payments, you're going to miss transactions. And for Musig 2, you might have a failure to be able to sign something to create a valid signature. So it's just a nice function here.
Awesome. Sorry to spring this on you, but may I punt the Rust Bitcoin update to you directly? Because I'm, yeah.
Sure. So Respicoin, a historic problem in Bitcoin, or I don't know if you want to call it a problem, but a historic confusion in Bitcoin is that we display hashes for certain things in Bitcoin backwards to the way they appear in actual serialized blocks and transactions. And this has to do with how Satoshi implemented proof of work in Bitcoin. There's no technical reason for it. It's just that he reversed things in order to be able to compare proof of work between blocks as a numeric value. And when the RPC interface was added later, it just displayed things it took the resulting data and displayed it backwards. And so this is very confusing to programmers. It doesn't really affect anybody. But when you see a block hash that starts with 00000, the way it appears in an actual serialized block, those zeros are at the end. And the Respicoin developers, you know, of course they have to implement this for stuff, but they don't want any additional hashes to be displayed backwards. So hashes for new parts of Bitcoin that are being added because of Taproot and other things, they're going to try to get everybody to display them in the natural order that comes out of that hash function. So this is this change here is a backwards incompatible change in their code with the way they were doing hashes for Taproot. But now they're going to display them in the way, I guess, that the output of the hash function naturally is displayed. Some people call this endianess. I've had other people yell at me because the output of a hash function outside of proof of work context is not a number. So we call this display order and internal byte order here. And like I said, this is just a really low level detail, but because if you've already implemented Taproot support using Rust Bitcoin, you might have to change your code. So we put this right up in the newsletter, just so you were aware of this and you could start testing out your code now.
Well, thank you for adding all this color, and I learned something. And also this whole display order versus hashing order, output order, that it's a huge pain in the neck and it confuses a lot of people to no end. So next item is a pull request to the BIPS repository. BIPS 1389 adds BIP 388, which describes wallet policies for descriptor wallets. Dave, would you happen to be able to jump in meanwhile?
I can certainly give it a try. So this is, I think of it as a reduced set of features from output script descriptors. So output script descriptors are great. I think everybody loves them. They are very broad because we want to capture, you know, a lot of the flexibility of script itself. Not the complete set of flexibility, but as much of it as we can in a way that's easy to analyze by a computer program. But that brings its own challenges to people who are implementing very secure wallets and wallets on limited devices, such as your typical hardware wallet today. All of that flexibility, it can be just complicated for the wallets to implement. So you want to simplify that set. But a main problem there is the user interface surrounding adding a wallet policy to your hardware wallet. So how much data do we want users to type into their wallet when they want to add a descriptor? They want to be part of a multi-sig, or they want to set up Lightning on their a support for Lightning on their hardware signing device, or they want to do other things. How much do we want them to type, and how much do we want them to carefully verify? And, you know, and in some cases, you know, we're dealing with, you know, not very experienced users. So we want to limit the amount of data here. So what BIP388 does is it slightly reduces the scope of the descriptor language, and it also fixes some of the data used in there. So instead of allowing you to use any public key, to use, you know, you don't have to use BIP32. You can use any path in BIP32 you want. You can use all this flexibility. We're going to limit to certain paths in BIP32. And we're just going to get a few changes like this that allow us to not display that information to users or display it in a very compact form. So instead of displaying the entire BIP32 path for verification, we just want to display the path at all because we're going to use a standard path in every case where we're using a multisig object. So like I said, it's a reduced set of output script descriptors that hopefully makes using a hardware wallet or another constrained computing and constrained display device a lot easier for everyday users.
Right. Thank you, Dave. So BIP388 specifies a bunch of templates on how to set up a wallet, an output descriptor, so it is especially hardware signer compatible. And I think another part that was in BIP388 is for stateless devices, obviously they wouldn't be able to store this policy that gets added to the hardware signer. Instead of needing to convince your hardware signer every time that it should be aware of some sort of wallet policy, you can register a hardware, a output script descriptor policy with the hardware signer, and you get a proof that the hardware signer itself registered it, and it is its policy. So you, when you pass something to sign, you just add that proof to it, and the hardware signer would know, oh, this is my own policy that I've agreed to before, and would be able to display it in this more user-friendly manner. Cool.
I have to confess, Merch, I didn't actually know about that that bit there, that it could sign its own policy and then you could load it in later. That's a really nice feature.
Yeah, it's really cool. And honestly, I actually reviewed this last week because I was the one to merge this BIP. And I thank you for bridging over. All right, we have two more. One is another pull request to the BIPs repository. This is BIPs 1567. It adds the BIP 387. I don't know why we have so many BIPs lately. It's really a lot of work, you know. So this is about the multi-A and sorted multi-A descriptors. As some people probably remember, when we introduced TypeScript, we got rid of the object multisig opcode in TypeScript because it's not compatible with batch verification. Instead, we have a way of doing multisig based on objectsig add and objectsig. Objectsig add. And what it does is it basically counts up the number of pub keys and checks whether signatures are there for everyone. So it's a different way of doing a multisig. So this descriptor this BIP specifies descriptors for this new way of doing multisig in TypeScript. We've had that in a few newsletters already. It's also been discussed on the mailing list probably. But if you're doing multisig stuff with Taproot enabled wallets, you're probably familiar with this BIP.
Yep, and the only thing I would add is that we've had support for this in Bitcoin Core for I think two releases now. So this is already out there. We're just getting, for some reason, these BIPs are just getting merged all of a sudden. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know what happened here. So finally, there's another BIP repository pull request, BIP 347 got merged, which proposes a new opcode called opcat. Cat is computer scientist lingo for concatenate, which just means combine two items by removing the space between them. And opcat would basically allow you to combine the top two items on the stack to a single stack item. It would be enabled only in TypeScript if it would be activated in a soft fork. So you've probably seen a little bit of discussion about opcat lately. There's a few people, or especially people that have been involved in the introspection and covenant debate, but also, for example, the BitVM proposal would benefit from being able to combine stack items. For example, this would allow you to create a Merkle proof in a transaction or to check whether something was included in the blockchain. It is still probably extremely block space intensive to use opcat to build more complex stuff, but it would also make a lot of things people are already looking into way more efficient. So if this sort of development interests you, opcat has been merged now. It is not BIP 420, as you might have read on social media. It is BIP 347.
I don't have anything to add there. We've talked about opcat a lot in the newsletter. I just checked, going all the way back to 2019. So if you want to know more about it, you can read more about it in the newsletter, or of course you can go read the BIP.
Yeah, so that would be all. If I don't see any speaker requests right now, we have one announcement attached to our newsletter at the bottom, which is we are looking to experiment with the publication date of the newsletter. So, Dave, do you want to talk about this a little bit?
Sure. When I started running the newsletter back in 2018, I was only planning to do a couple hours a week on it, and just to make sure I was able to do it, I scheduled it on the weekend. So we kind of built the newsletter around the idea that I would be writing it on the weekend. But here we are, 6 years later, and sometimes it takes more than a couple hours to write. And so I want my weekends back. And so we are playing around with the publication date. We're going to try to find a date that's good for me and is good for all of our readers too. And so we're going to be sending the newsletter out on different days and maybe doing some A/B testing where we send, you know, the newsletter to half of our subscribers on one day and half on a different day, and to see how many of them open up the newsletter. So it's just a little experimenting. Don't be surprised if you receive the newsletter on a different day than you expect. Don't be surprised if you hear that other people have been reading it, but you haven't received it yet. This will only be a really short period of testing for us to figure out what the best date is. And again, we apologize for, you know, any inconvenience there. Hopefully, in a week or two, we'll publish another announcement saying we've permanently switched to a different day for publication. And thanks for reading, guys.
Thank you so much, Dave, for writing the newsletter so consistently, so long. So thank you very much for coming to listen to our show. Thank you to Calvin to be our guest and my co-host, Dave, and for writing the newsletter. All right. Hear you soon.